Hello and welcome to everyone on the call. I'm Joanne Carter, Executive Director of Results for Results Ed Fund, and want to welcome you to this media conference call that's focused on addressing the IMF's role in responding to the global financial crisis. Today we're very pleased to offer the opportunity to hear from two very thoughtful experts on this subject. Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in D.C., and Rob Weissman, director of Essential Action and editor of the Multinational Monitor. Just over a year ago, the International Monetary Fund faced a shrinking loan portfolio and, in the midst of its own financial crisis, was seeking permission to sell part of its gold reserve to finance its operations. At that point, incoming IMF Director Dominique Strauss-Kahn identified the most serious issues for the fund as relevance and legitimacy. As the G20 prepares to meet in Washington this weekend, the global financial crisis has seemingly rescued the IMF from its identity crisis. We're deeply concerned, as an organization committed to addressing poverty, disease, and illiteracy, with the assumption that the IMF should have a central role in response to the financial crisis, particularly in the world's poorest countries. The IMF has a long and unfortunate track record of policy conditions and guidance that have constrained the ability of countries to ramp up spending to meet their own health and education needs, to support domestically led development, and to protect their vulnerable populations. In just one example, the onslaught of AIDS and the resurgence of tuberculosis have been exacerbated by decades of dismantling of public health systems in developing nations, due in no small part to the IMF-led policies. My own organization has long worked on fighting tuberculosis, and this year, researchers at Cambridge and Yale universities released a study showing a strong correlation between IMF austerity measures and increased rates of TB in Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union. Today, the IMF's work and mission are suddenly very much under consideration, and the fund is pushing for a much bigger role in the world. As the G20 leaders consider what that role should be, we have a clear message from this call. Simply put, the IMF should get out of the development business. We will hear in a moment from Rob Weissman about a specific reform agenda for the IMF that would help reverse this damaging track record. But first, we'll turn to Mark Weisbrot from the Center for Economic and Policy Research for his comments on the IMF's role in this current crisis. Mark, if you could go ahead, please.
Thanks, Joanne.
Yes, thanks.
So, just to start off, I mean, the IMF was heavily involved in the Asian crisis, and it was pretty much widely agreed among economists that they did very badly. At first, they waited too long. This was 10 years ago. These were countries that didn't have any insolvency problems, but just liquidity. They just needed foreign exchange, and they waited too long, and so a lot of the damage was done before they even began lending. And then when they did, they attached conditions that made the crisis worse, and as a result, you had large losses of output and huge increases in poverty rate and unemployment in Indonesia, South Korea, the Philippines, Thailand, and other countries affected by the crisis. So that was a major mistake, and it was huge. And as a result, for the last 10 years, you've seen the IMF basically excluded from lending to almost all middle-income countries. The Asian countries built up reserves so they would never have to go back to the IMF again, and they also created their own fund, a swap arrangement called the Chiang Mai Initiative, which began in 2000. And then, Latin America also made other arrangements since Argentina had the worst experience, one of the worst experiences of all in 1998-2000 with the IMF, where they also made it worse. So I won't go into all the history, but this is a very huge historic reversal that's taking place. I mean, the IMF, really, as I said, was just really not, nobody would go to them. And in fact, the Latin American, not one Latin American country yet, at least as far as we know, there's been no public discussion if it's happened, has been willing to go to the IMF. Now, why is this? Well, the IMF has kind of a double standard. They're very willing to support expansionary macroeconomic policies, what economists call counter-cyclical policies, in the rich countries. And they have for many years, even before this crisis, they nagged the European Central Bank, for example, to lower their interest rates just to promote growth. But they have a different attitude towards developing countries. They're they very often have supported what we call pro-cyclical policies. That is, the economy goes into recession, and they ask them to cut spending and raise interest rates, the two most important macroeconomic policies. And then they also, of course, have attached a number of side conditions that have to do with the interests of the board of directors of the IMF. Now, the question is, are they still doing this? And I would say yes. First of all, on the latter point, you can see that the Iceland, the package for Iceland, is now running into trouble because the countries that run the IMF, which is mainly the U.S., actually it's overwhelmingly the U.S. Treasury Department, but Europeans have particular interests for their corporations and banks, and in the case of Iceland, you know, the Netherlands and the U.K. and possibly some other countries are trying to force Iceland to settle with one of their or some of their banks before they get any money. So this is just an example of how particular interests within the countries that run the IMF can interfere with them doing what they're supposed to do. But the second more important thing, I think, on a world scale, is that all the countries that have, where they're reaching or trying to reach agreements with the IMF right now, Ukraine, Hungary, for example, Iceland, they're all, Pakistan, they're all, the IMF is once again imposing pro-cyclical conditions, which will make it more difficult for these economies to get out of recession or to counter the world recession. And this is really the worst thing you can do. The whole purpose, and I don't know how much time I have to explain the economics, but Joanne, you should cut me off, okay? Will you do that?
Yeah, no, go ahead, Mark.
Okay. Yeah. The economics of this is kind of important. I mean, there is a grain of truth to the IMF argument. There's a difference between, that we have to understand, there's a difference between developing countries and rich countries in one respect when it comes to pro-cyclical policies and or counter-cyclical policies. That is, they want to counteract the recession like China is doing, you know, with their $600 billion stimulus package. And by the way, China went through that last crisis growing 8-9% annually during the Asian crisis, while all their neighbors who were beholden to IMF policies shrank. And so that's a good example of, you know, what a difference it makes. But the rationale of the IMF, very simply, is that, you know, a country that, you know, like the U.S. or European countries or Japan, they have what's called a hard currency. And so they can borrow in their own currency, or they can borrow, and the world will take their currency, at least for some time. They can run trade deficits and current account deficits. We don't know how long, but for at least for some period of time. Whereas a poorer country, if they're running a current account deficit, or a developing country, almost anybody except the three that I mentioned, they're going to run into a balance of payments crisis fairly soon. So there is some truth, but the problem is that the whole purpose of the IMF loaning hard currency to these countries is so that they don't have to do what they would do in the absence of having the hard currency reserves loaned by the IMF. In other words, anybody can get rid of their balance of payments problem by going through a severe recession or a depression, because consumers and businesses cut back on spending, they cut back on imports. That's what would happen if there was no source of funding at all. So it very much defeats the purpose for the IMF to impose these kinds of conditions. If you're going to loan the money, the whole purpose of it is so that they can do what the rich countries are doing right now, which is to run deficits during a recession and lower interest rates and not have to, and be able to defend their currencies if necessary, so that they can continue to spend to avoid the recession that's unnecessary. And of course, we won't be able to avoid our recession completely in the United States, but if our government is bold enough and pursues the right policies, we'll minimize the impact of it, whereas countries that borrow from the IMF can very well find themselves having to worsen the impact of the recession that they would otherwise face. So that's the main points that I had. I'm happy to elaborate on any of them as you guys want.
Thanks a lot, Morgan. I'm going to ask Rob to lay out a specific reform agenda on this briefly related to the IMF, and then we'll have a chance for questions so that people can ask you to elaborate on that. So, Rob, if you could, Rob Weissman, if you could go ahead and just lay out some specifics for a reform agenda that's being proposed for the IMF that would help address some of these issues.
Thanks very much, Joanne.
Thanks, John.
I mean, I think the framework is as Mark says, and then the very short term framework, of course, is that we've got the G20 meeting coming up, the IMF finding itself with a new lease on life, trying to grab more resources, hoping to do more lending, and a lot of talk about a new role for the IMF in either regulating the global financial system or having some enhanced surveillance role with perhaps some lesser regulatory powers. And so in that context, exactly what it is the IMF is going to do is now very much up for discussion. It is going to be resolved partly by actual agreements and partly by the role that the IMF just asserts for itself and what the countries of the world permit the IMF to do. So in that context, it's a very fluid moment, and it seems pretty likely there's going to be increased resources flowing through the IMF, but there's great concern that those resources become the basis for the IMF to, as Mark suggested, continue, perpetuate, or worsen the same set of policies that it's advanced in the past. And even as their influence had diminished in the last decade in the middle-income countries, in the poorest countries of the world, they've still maintained their role as the dominant influence over national economic policy making with really quite disastrous results. So in emerging, there are various different global and U.S. national civil society groups that are saying we want to make sure that the IMF role as it's being resituated doesn't enable them to do that. There, I think if you haven't already, everyone on the call will shortly receive a draft of this of a civil society call for IMF policy reform that's being circulated. It's signed by Results and Our Group Essential Action, as well as the AFL-CIO, Action International, and many more to come. The key prongs of the agenda are the following. The first is that the IMF should exit the development business altogether. Concretely, that means that certain instruments of the IMF should be closed, the Poverty Reduction and Growth Facility, the Policy Support Instrument. Those are things where the IMF, and mechanisms by which the IMF has been very involved in national economic policy making and development policy outside of their area of expertise with very poor results and really disastrous consequences for especially health and education, basic social indicators in poor countries. So we want them out of the development business altogether. Second is to eliminate their mission creep. So in the areas where they're going to continue lending, as they do the lending, the conditions that are attached to the lending should be very much limited. They should have, to the extent there are conditions, they should be limited only to directly to the expertise and sort of core mission of the IMF, which is balance of payments issues, should not involve things such as privatization, labor market regulation, or trade liberalization. Third is that as the IMF and other mechanisms lead to really massive new public financing flows to developing countries, there should be debt cancellation for at least a large set of the poorest countries without any onerous structural adjustment conditions and without any additional weight. What we've seen is that debt cancellation is by far the most effective form of aid, and it frees up countries to spend their own resources to do the things that they want and need to do. Fourth is that the IMF should be prohibited from advancing any further financial sector liberalization demands. The IMF has actually made the situation worse throughout the world in terms of the current global financial crisis by encouraging or forcing countries to remove restrictions on the financial sector that would have immunized them to some extent from the current crisis. Fifth is that the IMF should be required to let countries pursue the expansionary macroeconomic policies that the United States and other rich countries are now doing, exactly as Mark said. And what we've seen, again, as Mark indicated, is this ongoing double standard, both in the terms of the IMF's dealing with countries coming to it now in the context of the financial crisis, but also in the IMF's day-to-day work, it's still advising countries to raise interest rates and to limit public spending. If you look, for example, in late October advice to South Africa, exactly the same kind of contractionary economic advice it's given for a long time is still what its experts are putting out on a day-to-day basis. And finally, the IMF has to be prohibited from competing public sector spending on crucial issues like healthcare and education. In the past, the IMF had directly required countries to restrict their healthcare budgets. They don't do that so much anymore. Much more frequent is the imposition of overall budget caps, in which they say, well, your country is free to spend more on healthcare, but only if it cuts back on underspending. In the real world, of course, healthcare doesn't have powerful domestic advocates, and it usually is sacrificed for other interests. But especially because healthcare and education spending involves the mobilization overwhelmingly of domestic resources rather than any use of any significant foreign imports, the rationale for limitations on government spending don't apply. So there are some other portions of the agenda that people are advancing, but I think those are the kind of half dozen crucial elements, and we're optimistic that as the IMF searches for a new role, it will be also constrained from repeating and continuing many of the harmful policies that it's pushed and forced on countries in the past.
Thanks very much, Rob. Operator, if you can let the journalists on the call know how they can get in the queue to ask a question, and then we'll go ahead with your questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if there are any questions, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. One moment, please. The first question is from Christopher Swan from Bloomberg. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there, guys. I just had a quick question. The thing that I was wondering is, in terms of this double standard, I was just wondering, couldn't the rationale for it be that America and European countries have just much greater borrowing power and credibility with capital markets, whereas so they can basically afford periods where they're not being particularly prudent, whereas if developing countries attempt to do this, then they're going to get very briskly slapped down by the capital markets. And the other kind of related question that I had was, have you not seen any improvement in the IMF conditionality? I mean, it does seem that they haven't attempted in quite the same way as they had in the past to sort of micromanage nations' economies when they're in a crisis situation. Thank you.
You want me to answer that?
Yeah, why don't you start, Mark?
Okay. I'll take the second part first. Is there an improvement in conditions? We don't really know because we don't know all the conditions. But I can tell you they're attaching conditions that, you know, I only mentioned the macro conditions. So in Ukraine, of course, they have austerity conditions there. They're going to have to balance their budget in 2009. But that's all we know. I mean, again, press reports. We don't know everything they're saying or doing. But they also have this condition that they should float their currency, allow their currency to float. Now, this could be a good or a bad policy depending on the situation. My guess is probably bad there, because if there's a lot of capital flight, you could have a crash and overshooting of the currency like you had during the Asian crisis that can cause a lot of havoc in the economy. That is, maybe their currency is overvalued and needs to devalue, but there are a lot of different ways to do that. You can do it slowly. You can have a crawling peg. There's all kinds of things, and so to have this extreme position that you have to let it float could end up being very damaging for Ukraine. So that's another example. Now, to the extent that their policies aren't as bad here as they have been in the past, I would say that the most important thing, and this is, I something I should have emphasized at the beginning. The most important thing right now, if we want to protect the countries, the developing countries, who after all didn't start this crisis, it originated in the rich countries, is to have competition. That is the biggest damage the IMF has been able to have in all these years and decades, is because it had a monopoly in these situations. And that's why, you know, 10 years ago, Larry Summers flew out to Asia and from the U.S. Treasury and said that Japan could not set up an Asian monetary. He told Japan, and the other countries had to go along, that they couldn't have an Asian monetary fund to bail out those countries in crisis. They want the IMF to be in charge. That's why Gordon Brown went to Abu Dhabi, which has somewhere between $600 and $800 billion of reserves in a country of a couple million people, and said, we need money for the IMF. They're going all over the world. Saudi Arabia is being in China. And it's very, very important, and I emphasize this, I can't overemphasize, that these countries do not give money to the IMF. That if they want to help other developing countries, that they loan the money themselves. And, okay, now the other part of the question was about whether the countries, the reason is they don't have the confidence of capital markets, that's why they have to adopt austerity policies. That's not really true. Again, there's a grain of truth to it, but it totally varies by country. So Bolivia, for example, is the poorest country in South America, right? And they don't have any confidence of any capital markets. But they have more reserves than China right now relative to their economy, $8 billion. I can guarantee you they're not going to have any problem. If they want to pursue, they're growing, their first quarter growth was 6% year over year, which is the highest they've had for many, many years. If they want to continue that, they can continue that. They can pursue expansionary policies, and there's no problem, because the constraint is just your foreign exchange. That's all it is. Okay, that's why China can have a $600 billion stimulus program right now. If you have the foreign exchange, then you're in the same position as a rich country, in the sense that you can pursue the expansionary policies as long as you don't run the risk of running out of foreign exchange. That's what the constraint is.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Mark. Next question?
So the next question is from Aditya Chakraborty from Guardian. Please go ahead.
Hello. I'm just wondering, what kind of pressure do you see for reform of the IMF, and where is it coming from?
We can both speak to that if you want. Rob, go ahead.
Well, we're in a different situation now than we were 4 months ago. In a sense, the most overwhelming pressure for reform at the IMF, as Mark was saying, came from middle-income countries, which just decided they weren't going to have anything to do with the institution. I think the current situation may require them to revisit the decision, but the reluctance of the middle-income countries to go back to the IMF is certainly giving them some leverage and some possibility for altering the terms of IMF loans. I think, and among the poor countries, there's really, where there have been, you know, countless riots over IMF-imposed policy, there's really pressure from the ground, and that does translate through government. In the rich countries, I think stemming from that, you've seen civil society organizations responding to the sort of the cries of desperation from poor countries, and also very directly related to the impact of IMF policy on healthcare and education. So people are successfully getting rich countries to allocate large sums of aid for AIDS and for other healthcare priorities, and they're seeing their efforts being undermined or stymied by IMF policy. I think that's had quite an important effect in mobilizing people in rich countries, and that in turn has led to a lot of sympathetic ears in not just in the U.S. Congress, but in the U.K. as well, and also in a variety of the other European countries. So there's definitely a lot of distrust of the IMF from all quarters, and it's going to be a miracle if they're able to sort of pull themselves up from the dead and to capitalize on this global crisis. And the real challenge, though, is to make sure that if they're able to manage that in some way, that it's done, that their new powers are constrained and they're not able to repeat the mistakes of the past.
Mark, anything you would add, or should we go on to the next question?
Well, just one quick thing. I want to emphasize the competition. When I said that they should loan directly, there's also regional solutions. You know, the Chiang Mai Initiative, for example, in Asia, is existent. It does unfortunately have a condition that if a country wants to borrow more than 10%, I think it is, of the swaps, they have to go to the IMF for approval. So there's been moves to get rid of that over the years, and they may do that. And they may make that into a genuine Asian monetary fund at some point. But I want to just say one thing about, there's something very terrible going on right now, if you look at it, that the IMF is a part of. And that is that, you know, this crisis started here in the U.S. And to a lesser extent other rich countries who bought the toxic mortgage-backed security. And then it spread to the rest of the world. And so what happened is that the rich countries, because they have these hard currencies and more borrowing power in general, they were able to guarantee their banking systems to a large degree, as we have in the U.S. We've now guaranteed, you know, money market mutual funds and a whole number of other kinds of deposits that weren't before, commercial paper. And so what happens is that a lot of money is leaving the developing countries and going to the rich countries. This is why the Eastern European was hit so hard. They just go right to the rest of Europe. And so what the U.S. Treasury is doing in conjunction with Europe, because they run the IMF, and also they're using the Fed. They created a $30 billion swap line for Brazil and Mexico and South Korea. And that was partly because the IMF has such a bad reputation in those countries that they, you know, it might have been politically too hard to extend, offer an IMF loan. But what they're doing is they're using the crisis to reward the countries that they want to reward and punish the others. So because the money is flying out of the developing countries, they can then say, okay, if you're the country that's done what we wanted over the last few years, then you'll have access to foreign exchange, and if you're not, you're in trouble. So that's a very bad thing. And so to the extent, if the IMF, I'm hoping the IMF will not get this monopoly or near monopoly of lending that it had in the Asian crisis. But if it does get it, there should be a major demand, I guess I would add that to Rob's list, should be transparency and fairness in who gets money. If it's a global bailout fund and countries are contributing extra money, you know, Japan's going to kick in another $100 billion to the IMF. And then the World Bank is going to loan to developing countries, which I think seems to be kind of outside its mission, which is help the poorest countries. Now they're going to have $100 billion so that they too can contribute to this effort to have Treasury increase its influence all over the world and be able to decide who gets help and who doesn't. So that, I think, should be another major demand, is that any lending that the IMF does, that's a multilateral effort, should be without discrimination based on political grounds, which is what's happening right now.
Next question is from Chris Cermak from DPA. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the new lending facility that the IMF set up, this short-term lending facility, which at least it says is going to be given to countries that have a track record of sound fiscal policies without the conditions that it usually attaches in terms of the things that you were talking about. So I was wondering if you could speak to that, if that is an improvement from your perspective on what they do. And as a follow-on from that, what do you think of the world... perhaps if you could quickly talk about what the World Bank's role in lending is, if they also are going to be lending to countries, do they attach the same kinds of conditions? Thanks.
You want
who do you? Why don't you go ahead, Mark? I'll follow up.
Okay. Well, the catch is here. Who has the sound? I mean, they don't even. I haven't seen them say sound fiscal policies. I've seen them say sound macroeconomic policies and well behaved. I've seen those two words to describe. I haven't seen. So the question is, who gets this? Okay. Look at and look at South America, for example. All those countries have enormous amounts of reserves. Brazil, Argentina even has $47 billion in reserves. Venezuela, $70 billion. They were asking for money, but Ecuador, Paraguay, even as a percent of GDP, all of these countries, Bolivia, as I mentioned before, they're not. You don't see the IMF offering them loans, and that's. I think that it's totally political. It really isn't based on what they consider to be sound policies. Would be, you know, did you do the kind of things that we wanted you to do over the last 5 or 10 years? Privatize, have. Open up your various sectors to foreign direct investment in the ways that you want it. And yes, the World Bank, by the way, you know, they're not an independent actor in this for the most part. They generally join the conditionality of the IMF.
Yeah, I would echo that. I mean, I think on the first point, in principle, it's good that the new money will go out without with minimal or no conditionality. The problem is if the implicit condition is this business of being well behaved, which just basically means you did everything we would want you to do anyway because you understand how we set the rules of the game. And on the second point, for the bank, I think a very unfortunate evolution, another kind of mission creep mission recreep perhaps for the bank. The bank has had a very large role in this kind of lending throughout the 80s and the 90s, and as a result of its failure and advocacy efforts, it's shifted its role away from the kind of macroeconomic stuff it's now looking to get back into. And it's in conditional loans. There are huge problems with what the bank has been doing, but there's been more focus on grant-based aid and some openness, at least, despite many, many flaws in what the bank does, to sort of results-oriented development work. And I think the new program that Zelix just announced sounds like we're in for more of the bad old days.
Thanks a lot. Next question?
Yeah, the next question is from Greg Robb from MarketWatch.com. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for organizing this call. I guess my question is more related to the G20 this weekend. And don't you get this? I thought the sense was that the countries have to come here to Washington to work together so that they don't do any beggar thy neighbor stuff that gets the crisis worse. What do you think about that? And I mean, I guess this Iceland thing is part of that in the sense that it seems very difficult that countries aren't going to start doing things that, you know, benefit them instead of just the whole system. You know, if the UK and the Netherlands want Iceland to do certain things before they'll give them money. Is any comment on that?
The biggest beggar thy neighbor thing that countries can do and the thing you want to avoid is competitive devaluation, where every country tries to export its way out of the crisis. And that's why I mentioned the Ukraine, case where they're asking to float their currency in a situation where that could really crash. Now, it's one thing, obviously, if the currency is overvalued, you know, every country has to determine what's the competitive level for their exchange rate. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they do have overvalued currencies, and they should let it fall. I think that's where you need the most coordination. And, you know, again, China is pulling its weight just as it did in the Asian crisis, where everybody everybody else did, in fact, export their way out of the crisis by letting their currencies crash, and that's part of the reason they had all the damage, whereas China embarked on a huge fiscal stimulus. It was actually, I think, bigger than the one they're proposing now, which is 7% of GDP. So I think that is a role that if you had an institution that really was looking out for primarily for the interest of the global economy and not so much for the policy or ideological interests or particular interests of the board of directors that the IMF has often done, you would see an attempt to coordinate exchange rate policy.
I think also one thing that's emerged, and there's some recognition of this, even in sort of IMF-type policy circles, is that the IMF and sort of embraced the Wall Street ideology of over-financialization, and they pushed countries to do all kinds of financial sector liberalization and to allow, on the belief that the finance sector would drive the economy rather than serve the economy. And there's a need now to shrink the finance sector down to a reasonable size. This is true in the United States as well as everywhere else, where in 2004, 2007, the finance sector was taking about over a third of corporate profits overall, which is an extraordinarily high number. And a lot of, you know, there's a theoretical world in which all the countries could do that kind of shrinking together. But the main thing that countries need is to have the removal of the pressures that came from the IMF and the freedom to do things, to impose capital controls, impose appropriate regulations on their financial bodies, to take greater greater public sector role in the financial sector. And the big thing that I'd like to see come out of, you know, the big thing I'd like to see everybody agree on is that countries should have that freedom. They don't have to agree to all do it in the same way, but they ought to have the freedom to do it. And that's been very hard, especially for developing countries because of IMF pressure. And there are very new threats in that regard now, from new agreements being discussed at the World Trade Organization and ongoing threats to a whole series of bilateral investment agreements the United States has entered into.
Can I add to that? Because that's an extremely important point that Rob just made, and I wanted to add a little bit to that. Is that okay, Joanne?
Please go ahead, Mark.
Because that's really, really important. The whole question of capital controls. Because that's something that, you know, you're not reading about, because there's so much pressure not to do that, that not that many countries are considering it. One country that is Russia. They've lost $112 billion in the last few months defending the ruble. This is a very, very expensive way, and they can't keep doing it, to keep... And again, it's defending against speculative attacks. That's all it is. It's not like that Russia has insolvent banks like the U.S. or anything. It's just purely speculative attacks. Now, the other way to deal with this is what they ended up doing back in 98 and 99 was to impose capital controls. And it's not that hard, actually. It worked at that time. They cut, it's not leak-proof, especially when you have a lot of corruption, but at that time it cut the capital flight from $27 billion to about $6.5 billion. So they might end up doing this, but there are other countries in a similar situation that are going to be told by the IMF, and the IMF is going to, you know, help create pressure not to do this. And I think this is one of the most important mechanisms for a lot of countries, and it's going to be, if there is anything that we're, you know, all the talk about the new financial architecture, if there is anything that's going to create any kind of a new financial architecture, it's going to involve capital control. So that was one of the fundamental bases of the Bretton Woods system.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mark. Do we have any other questions, operator?
Yes, we do. The next question is from David Moberg from Indies Times. Please go ahead.
Yes, you were arguing that the IMF should not be the agency that promotes any new financial regulation of the global economy. Do you think that should be done by any international body? And if so, do you have thoughts on how that new global control should develop.
You want me to take that first, or?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead, Mark? Thank you.
Well, I'm not as worried about them having a huge role, and they've kind of said I think they didn't want one in regulating the global economy. I'm pretty sure Dominique Strauss-Kahn said that the other day. And the reason I'm not as worried about that, I don't think that's on the foreseeable future agenda. But definitely they shouldn't. If there's anybody who wants, I guess, the French might want them to do that. And I don't think so. No, just because they've gotten the economics wrong so many times for so many years that they just wouldn't be the organization to do this. Now, who should do it? If they do, this is a very theoretical question because we're talking about, years away. It took us a Great Depression and a World War to get the last Bretton Woods Agreement, and I don't think any of these leaders are quite scared enough yet to create anything like that. But if they were to do something like that, they would have to create a new organization and one that had representation, adequate representation from developing countries as well. And so the IMF would definitely not be it.
Yeah, I think that's for sure right. A couple additional points. One is that there are, most of the things that are being talked about by the Europeans and others are not things that really need to be done at the global level. Countries just need to step forward and go ahead and do them. And I think that actually the Europeans put out a lot of bullet points that are the kind of many but not all of the top priority concerns, but it's not clear that they attach to them substantive provisions that go nearly far enough. The second, but countries can really do this stuff on their own to a very considerable extent. And the second concern is that there are some global regulatory mechanisms, and the problem is that they establish limits on what countries can do rather than a floor of what they must do with further freedom to more tightly regulate the financial sector. And I think that's a big concern with the ongoing GATS negotiation, as well as many of these sort of overlapping bilateral and regional investment and other agreements. There's an arguable point about you could view Basel as a kind of Basel II as a kind of global regulatory regime that's been very harmful too under the influence of the banking sector.
Thanks very much. Do we have any additional questions?
Once again, if there are any additional questions, please press star then one on your touch-tone phone. There are no further questions at this time.
Okay, thanks very much to our speakers, and thanks for everyone for joining this call and for your participation. Just a couple of things. If some journalists on the call have not yet received and would want a copy of the civil society call for IMF policy reform, or if you would want to follow up with any of the speakers, you can contact Robin Shepherd at Results, and she can facilitate that. And that email is rshepherd, rshepherd, at results.org. And also, we will have a transcript of this call later today, and you can also hear a replay of this call by calling, I'll give you that number in case you want to get any replay, 888-203-1112. Sorry, I have to give you a passcode, 409-7561. And again, for any further information or follow-up with the speakers, you can contact Robin Shepherd at Results, and we'll facilitate that. Thanks, everyone, for being on this call and your attention to this important topic. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.